Wonderful. Well, I'm very pleased to see you. Hopefully you've got the handout. That gives you an outline of everything we're thinking about. And I think you'll get a sense of this seminar series as a whole. So it's going to be sort of bits and bobs as we go along. But hopefully by the end of the week, all these bits and bobs will have come together and you'll see how it all fits. I'm going to be thinking about why we need the imagination and how significant the imagination is. And I'm going to give sort of hints of that, but that's mainly going to be days 3 and 4. The first 2 days, I'm going to be focused mainly on the Old Testament and how we understand the resurrection from the Old Covenant, because that's something that always puzzled me, and I could never really find people who would help me explore that. So that's what spurred me to go down these various rabbit holes. But I thought I'd start by focusing on that famous conversation that happened on the road to Emmaus. And, of course, last night we were thinking about Mary at the tomb, and she didn't recognize Jesus. And later on the same day, you had those two leaving Jerusalem in despair, because we had thought he was the one to redeem Israel, but obviously he isn't, and so that's why we're leaving. And it's an incredibly dramatic and fascinating sort of sequence. The story of that conversation with this mystery walker on this road has absolutely gripped, particularly artists. And it's fascinating. I did a sort of bit of a dig and found all kinds of different artists have painted this scene. I thought I'd share one or two with you. And it's fascinating how different artists have taken different moments of that episode. Here's a very recent one to begin. And this is a Ukrainian artist called Ivanka Demchuk. And she sets the scene in a Ukrainian winter. So it's very white, it's very sort of, it feels cold. And basically this is just the moment just before Jesus starts talking to the two. So it's anticipating the whole narrative. Similarly, this is another one painted by someone called Liz Mennell, who just happens to be my mum. And she painted this about 25 years ago. And again, basically, it's the moment just before the Lord comes and starts talking to these two. So we are eavesdropping on a moment knowing what is going to happen. I guess most people who've read their Bibles will know this story, and so these images will really resonate. And then here's another recent one from China by a man called Hei Qi, and this was painted in 97. And Jesus has just joined these two now on the road to Emmaus. Hei Qi has done an amazing series of Bible stories from the whole of the Bible in this sort of quite stylized sort of Asian style. They're fascinating. But then the travelers are in conversation, and it goes on, and they begin to realize that this guy is really quite interesting, and he makes out to go on, and they say, no, please stay with us. And so here, going back a long time to the Middle Ages, to a man called Duccio from Italy, this is a fresco, and basically the two are about to go into this town in the sort of classic Italian medieval style. And they're saying to Jesus, look, come stay with us. We want to carry on this conversation. So they're ushering him to go with them. Again, the similar moment here is in a Byzantine mosaic from a millennium before even. And again, they're wanting him to stay because he's so interesting. But then they get to the meal itself. This is one of my favorites by Velázquez from Spain. This is from 1618. And at first sight, you think that this is a picture of a maid in a kitchen. And you only just realize that in the top left corner, in the next room, in the distance, is the conversation at the table. This is the Emmaus conversation. And I love the fact that she is sort of eavesdropping. So she's getting to listen in on this conversation. Isn't it a wonderful image of this African maid trying to eavesdrop? And in a sense, she's doing what we're doing. we're eavesdropping on this amazing conversation. I mean, you know, who wouldn't want to have been at that Bible study? But the most common moment that is picked out by artists is the moment of recognition. And here's Rembrandt, and he's just appeared to them as he is. And it's the sort of nanosecond, the split second of that moment when they suddenly know who it is. It's very exciting. Rembrandt returned to this theme many times. He did lots of different versions. He would become obsessed with different things and just repeat coming back to them, always slightly different, always seeing something new. And again, this moment of recognition is captured by Caravaggio, who was an incredibly dramatic painter. And it's just that moment of recognition that you see the guy in the front is just sort of about to stand up in awe. So it's literally that split second. And then the most adventurous of them all is Rembrandt. He manages to capture in this etching the moment when Jesus disappears, which is quite clever. you know, they suddenly recognize who he is, and then he's gone. And they're trying to sort of, you know, come to terms with what's just happened. It's fascinating, and I love looking at all of these, and there are many others I could have chosen. Just from this one narrative, it's a scene that has absolutely gripped people down the centuries. But why focus on that at the start? Well, for one thing, this is one little scene in the resurrection story that has gripped people's imaginations. And they thought about each little moment in it, imagining being there, what it must have been like. And I love how each one, just in the short survey we've seen, picks up on a different moment, a different aspect of it. But what is interesting is that none of them are able actually to capture the thing that Luke wants us to focus on in Luke 24. Because what is the focus? As these two start, you know, immediately processing what they have just experienced, and they're looking back and saying, you know, just as he broke the bread, that's when we recognized who he is. And you might think, okay, that means this is all about the communion. And there's definitely a sense in that. He's breaking bread before the meal. That's what you do. And there's a sense in which, oh, we've seen him do that before, perhaps. So there is definitely a sort of echo of him instituting the Lord's Supper. But that's not what they mention. When they think back to this extraordinary moment, what do they pick up? It's how our hearts burned within us as he opened the scriptures. It was this incredible Bible study that was the thing that absolutely blew their minds. It made their hearts burn. And he tells the whole narrative of the Bible in terms of how he fits. Or actually the other way around, how the Bible fits him. That he is the central focus of the entire Bible. Now, how do you paint the entire Bible story in one image? You can't. But you can tell the story. And isn't it interesting that God hasn't given us just a list of bullet points and theological ideas? He's told us a story. And stories work because they capture our imaginations. I want us to bear that in mind in all the things we think about. This is part of a story. So what do they focus on at the Emmaus Road? Well, it's interesting. There are parallels in the whole of that Luke 24 chapter and in John 20 that we are working through in the evenings. You know, you have various appearances of angels and of the Lord, as we saw last night. And the disciples, they're given a little bit of a hard time. It's not a massively hard time. But Jesus is, you know, he's not tetchy or anything. He's not annoyed. But he's simply saying, hang on. Remember at the beginning of chapter 24 of Luke? Why do you look for the risen among the dead? the risen. You should be looking for a risen one. In other words, don't be such an idiot to look for Jesus here. And then to the two on the Emmaus Road, he says, "How foolish you are, how slow to believe. All the prophets have spoken." And then later on in the upper room, what does Jesus say there? "Why are you troubled? Why did doubts rise in your mind?" And then, do you remember last night? Twice Mary is asked by the angels and by the Lord, "Why are you crying?" And then to Thomas, "Stop doubting and believe." You should know this. The question is, why? What was the problem? I mean, why should they have known about the resurrection? That's the key. Why should it not have come as a surprise? I mean, I can imagine, you know, we see how Jesus repeatedly speaks of his impending betrayal, handed over to the chief priests and so on, and to be crucified and made alive again. I can imagine that when they hear him repeat that little sort of refrain, I can imagine they say, yep, sort of trying to take it in. And it's so much that actually when he tacks on the resurrection at the end, they don't even get there. It's like, what? Betrayed? I mean, they're stuck on betrayed, perhaps, or executed. It's all too much. So they should have known because Jesus had told them. He said this was going to happen. But still, none of them, not one of them, was really prepared for it. But the second thing, and this is the fascinating thing, this is what really gripped me as I was preparing this. The second thing is, the scriptures told you that this was going to happen. So Luke 24, "How foolish you are, and so, how slow to believe all that the prophets have spoken." This is verse 26 of Luke 24. "Did not the Messiah have to suffer these things and then enter his glory? And beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he explained to them what was said in all the scriptures concerning himself." Now, that's been a very familiar verse and an important verse for me and my discipleship, because it's one of the key sort of motivations to wanting to study the Old Testament, isn't it? Yeah, we study the Old Testament because it was Jesus' Bible and he would always preach from it. But this is sort of an added dimension to it. We study the Old Testament because it's all about him. But the question that I've always been troubled by is, I get how the Old Testament anticipates the cross, and there are many verses, Psalm 22, Isaiah 53, and so on and so forth, many verses, as well as the sacrificial system in the Torah, in the Pentateuch, in the law. All of these different elements help us to understand the cross. But the resurrection, I don't really find that. And it's always puzzled me, and I've been looking for that sort of knockout verse that says, okay, and on the third day he's going to rise. Well, you are not going to find it. It's not there. But what I think we will find, and I think there is plenty to talk about, more than enough. In fact, we're going to run out of time, almost certainly. That's because I usually run out of time. But... we're going to find that actually there are lots of elements dotted around, and it's basically about piecing these bits together to see how they make the whole. So that actually Jesus is not stretching things, he's not imposing things on the scriptures. Yes, it is all genuinely there, but you've got to work for it. And that's what we're going to do. But just to break things up a little bit, just talk with a neighbor for a minute. We can't sort of get into huddles because of the arrangement of the tent. But get into sort of ones or twos where you're sitting and just answer this question just amongst yourselves. Why is it that we grieve? As a matter of principle, why do we grieve when someone dies? Now, for some, that might be very close to the bone and recent. But think about it in generalities. Why do human beings grieve? Over to you for a minute or two. Okay, let's look up there. That was very contrived and artificial, and you have to stop talking now. however deep and profound it got. And I am not going to find out what everybody thought or said. Not because I'm not interested much. Purely logistics. But it is interesting, isn't it, that we grieve for all kinds of reasons. I mean, relationships, apart from anything else, must be the primary one. But I think at its heart, deep down, we grieve because life is good and special. And when it is ended, there's something deeply ingrained in us that feels that's wrong. It just doesn't compute. It's just, even, you know, we sort of cozy it up a little bit, and particularly maybe somebody's had a long illness and it's been, you know, a long battle or whatever, and we... It, maybe that's a little bit better to have some kind of merciful release or whatever we talk about it as, but even then, even when it's been most expected, there's something wrong about it. And I think that's appropriate. I think that's how it should be, because life is precious. It is a gift. And God created this gift, and so it feels really wrong when it is over. And I want to look at one or two ways in which the Old Testament demonstrates the preciousness of life. Now, you may think, how does this all fit? I promise you, it will lead into the bigger picture. But... you remember how when the man and woman are thrown out of the garden, the reason they are thrown out is to prevent them having access to the tree of life. And that's a disaster. It's a disaster for people who are rebels against the Creator to live forever. I mean, imagine the carnage. It's bad enough with people living 70 years and 10. No, it is not right for rebels to live forever. So God bars the way with that sword. But that doesn't mean to say that God has given up on life. And there are extraordinary little hints of this. So look at what happens to Cain in Genesis 4. If you have a Bible, do work back with me. But, you know, the first death in the Bible, extraordinarily, is not what you might call a natural one. It's a murder, but it's not just any murder, it's a fratricide. And look at Cain's response, look at God's response to Cain. Cain is worried about his banishment and what's going to happen to him, and that is understandable. Genesis 4:13, Cain said to the Lord, "My punishment's more than I can bear. Today you are driving me from the land, and I'll be hidden from your presence. I will be a restless wanderer on the earth, and whoever finds me will kill me." Now you might think, and your point is, it's only what you did. But God protects him. God, the Lord said to him, "Not so. Anyone who kills Cain will suffer vengeance 7 times over. Then the Lord put a mark on Cain so that no one who found him would kill him. So Cain went out from the Lord's presence, lived in the land of Nod, east of Eden. That's an extraordinary little moment when you think about it. Here is a murderer receiving grace, albeit quite limited, but he is protected by the one he offended in killing his brother. Incidentally, just a small point, wider point about punishment in the Old Testament that often gets overlooked. You see, time and time again, the scriptures indicate that the seriousness of a crime, the seriousness of a sin, is indicated by, excuse me, by giving the maximum sanction. That does not mean that that maximum sanction must be carried out every time. And in fact, some of the more serious ones, you know, the capital punishments in history were often not carried out. But it's saying in your experience as the people of God living together that this particular sin is so serious that it carries a maximum penalty. It doesn't mean that it has to be exerted. And this is one of those situations, isn't it, with Cain. You might think, well, you know, Cain's murder will never happen because of God's mark. The punishment is there to say, this is a very terrible thing, which in itself exactly actually shows how terrible Cain's murder of his brother was in the first place. It's not made right by Cain being murdered as well. So here you have this sort of rather ambiguous moment. The life of a murderer is protected. There is something intrinsically good about life. We turn on to Leviticus and those extraordinary, sort of rather alien to us, laws about the sacrificial system and about blood. So you have this very weird bit in chapter 17. Let me read from 17, verse 10. I will set my face against any Israelite or foreigner residing among them who eats blood, and I'll cut them off from the people. You think, what? It's a bit extreme, a bit bizarre. Why? Why this serious sanction? For the life of a creature is in the blood, and I've given it to you to make atonement for yourselves on the altar. It is the blood that makes atonement for one's life. Do you remember what Andy Prime on the first evening was talking about with all that stuff about linen and goats? Unusual approach, but he was spot on. Therefore, I say to the Israelites, none of you may eat blood, nor may any foreigner residing among you eat blood. Why? Blood is a powerful symbol. In the pre-medical world, there are no antiseptics, no antibiotics. Even a simple graze actually could prove fatal. It could be game over if it gets infected and basically gets through your whole system and you're gone. I mean, life is so fragile. I mean, it's amazing that any of us survive a day. Some of us more than others. And so the sight of blood was a very serious thing. Seeing blood where it should not be, as in outside the body. Uh-oh, what's going on? Are you okay? There was a very real sense, you know, regardless of the biology, although it does fit with the biology, there's a very real sense that the life really is in the blood. And if the blood has come out even from a graze, it could be the end of your life. Blood sustains life around the body, but then it might equally represent the end of that life. And that is why, actually, it then becomes a kind of shorthand for substitution, for one life instead of another life, to make atonement, to make us at one with God. One life for the sake of another. And this is the key to open the entire Old Testament sacrificial system. At the tabernacle and subsequently the temple, the believer confesses their sins before God and an animal sacrifice is made to deal with it, and the blood makes atonement. But notice who gives this sacrifice. God. We don't give the sacrifice. God is the one who gives a sacrifice for atonement. I can't do that. You can't do that. There is nothing you or I, not one thing we can do to deal with our sinfulness. No, the whole system is a gift in itself from the Lord. It is all of grace. Grace that rescues us. Hold that in mind. One life for another life. The life of the creature is in the blood. But there is a call, therefore, for dedicated lives. You remember, as God has brought the people out of Egypt, and they're gathered at the foot of the mountain, Mount Sinai, which is the same place where the burning bush, or as I think it should be called, the non-burning bush, happened. You know, Moses has an encounter with God, and the whole point is that it's not burning, it just looks like it. So it's the non-burning bush. And God says, you'll bring my people back to this place, and there they are again at Sinai. And what does God say before he gives the law? In its summary, in the 10 words, the 10 commandments. What does God say? Exodus 20. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, the land of your slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. Who has done the saving? God. Later on in Israel's history, they want to be like the other nations, but no other nation has anything like what Israel was given. They have a God who intervened. It was his idea. He organized it. He worked it all out because basically, humanly speaking, it was impossible for them to be saved. They certainly couldn't save themselves. Can an entire sort of nation of slaves overcome the masters? No. It's a gift of God, God's grace, yet again. And grace is, if you like, the oxygen through which the law is breathed. The law itself is a gift of grace for people who are saved and brought out of slavery. This is the life they're to live because he has given them life. I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of Egypt. That is his identity, and it is their identity. That is what makes them. That's what constitutes them. If you like, you know, the Mount Sinai, gathering of the people, was the constitution of this new nation. God has done the saving. They're no longer slaves, but another place earlier in Exodus 19, he describes being bringing them out on eagle's wings. So how do you respond to that? Here's another little question to chat with your neighbor. How might you summarize Old Testament ethics, which is a very posh way of saying, in the light of that, how do you live? Over to you. Okay. I'm sure you've answered that adequately and sufficiently and fully. I won't pick on any individuals that I know, but I hope those that I know are feeling insecure. Obviously, there's a whole Old Testament. But I think two key principles lie behind Old Testament ethics. The first is holiness. God is holy, 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 three times holy. Leviticus 19, the Lord said to Moses, speak to the entire assembly of Israel and say to them, be holy, because I, the Lord your God, am holy. I've heard sometimes theologians say, well, of course, the Bible is all about love. Well, I'm going to come to that. It is. But a lot of people shy away and rarely talk about holiness. God is holy, holy, holy. What does that mean? It's about being set apart. It's about being different. Not like all the other gods, not like any other culture. So this explains actually even some of the weirder laws, maybe some of the food laws. You see, yeah, we can find, you know, interesting reasons why certain food laws might be there and say, yeah, it's to do with hygiene and all this sort of stuff. Well, kind of, but sometimes that doesn't quite fit. Sometimes they feel a bit arbitrary, and I think that's the point. The point is, you're only going to do this if God tells you to do this. It's a sign that you take him seriously. He's saying, be different. I know everybody all around you is eating shellfish, but I want you to be different. So to indicate that I'm first in your life, don't eat these things and don't touch that. Do you see? Be holy, be different. Because you're not like any other nation. You are to be holy because I'm holy. Which is why when they want a king, when Samuel is the judge, it is such a tragedy that they say we want to be like other nations. That is gutting. You're not. Be holy as I am holy. That explains the Sabbath. I mean, there are lots of good things about recognizing the Sabbath, but in essence, it's to say God comes first. And if he says this day is set apart, it's set apart. Be different. And yes, of course, love comes into it. Secondly, from the same chapter, Leviticus, actually, as well as many others I could have gone to. Leviticus 19 again. Do not seek revenge or bear a grudge against any one of your people. Love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord. Yes, love is central, but it goes hand in hand with holiness. Do not wedge them apart. Or in Deuteronomy 6, which is where you get a kind of recapitulation of the law. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength. Love God, love your neighbor. That is the summary of the law. Jesus endorses that. Yes, law and love is very, very important. It is central. But so is holiness. And I think all of that is because the lives we live are so precious to God because he made them and because he brought us out of slavery in Egypt, that he wants us to live them well. And these, as well as many others, are the reasons why human sacrifice is such a terrible, appalling idea. God loves life. He invented it. He says, worship me according to these rules and regulations. This is how you're to worship me. It is not up to us to decide and say, actually, I quite like to worship God by eating fish fingers on Thursdays. That is my act of devotion. No, he said, this is how you're to do it. You're going to have a tabernacle, and you're going to have sacrifices. Oh, well, that's a bit of a faff, Lord. Can't we find an easier way, something a bit more time-saving? No, I am the Lord your God. You do this. And so in Deuteronomy, as well as Leviticus, this is what God has said. You must not worship the Lord your God in their way. In other words, these other nations with their other gods and their other religious practices. You're not to be like them, like other nations. You're to be focused on the Lord who has intervened, taken the initiative to give his law. But this is what Deuteronomy 12 goes on to say. You mustn't worship in their way. Why? Because in worshiping their gods, they do all kinds of detestable things that the Lord hates. They even burn their sons and daughters in the fire as sacrifices to their gods. Can you believe it? But of course, you're not to do that. God loves life. Life is not an accident. We are not the result of biological and chemical chance. God made us, and he made life. He loves it. It is such an inherently good thing. The idea that you would kill a child to please the gods is utterly despicable. But this is where things now suddenly get very confusing. Because there are one or two moments where it seems in the Old Testament that God expects exactly that. If life is so precious, what are these stories doing in the Bible? Well, we go to the book of Judges. That should ring all kinds of alarm bells in your head. You think, uh-oh, okay, it's not going well. All right, book of Judges, be very careful what you take as your models. The book of Judges is X-rated. Why it's so popular with Sunday school classes, I do not know. Well, no, I do know. It's because it's X-rated. And you have that famous kind of refrain four times at the end of the book. Everybody in those days, in those days, Israel had no king. Everyone did as they saw fit. It's basically DIY ethics and religion. Make it up as you go along. Worship God how you think is appropriate and just get on with life. And if that means beating up your neighbor, especially your fellow tribesmen, then, well, that's the way it is. And so we come to Jephthah. Oh, dear. Have Judges 11 visible, would you? I'm just going to race through the details. He's a bit of a complex chap. In fact, nearly everybody in Judges is a complex chap or chapess. Basically, Jephthah was a pretty messed up kid, born on the wrong side of the blanket of his father, Gilead. He was resented by his half-brothers until they needed him, of course. And suddenly, he's flavor of the month. So they employed Jephthah to be head of their armed forces because they are under threat. And they need someone, they need a judge who is a sort of combination of king, magistrate, and general all into one. And they need him to lead them because otherwise they are easy prey. Jephthah, I think, has a good idea, and it's agreed on by the other elders that basically they need to try diplomacy first. It's always a good idea. So he basically tries to play the diplomat and negotiate with Ammon, but with classic disdain. Judges 11:28, the king of Ammon, however, paid no attention to the message Jephthah sent him. Yeah, I'm not interested in that. And we see that Jephthah is committed to God. I mean, he loves God and wants to do the right thing. So, his dedication is clear. Verse 30, he made a vow to the Lord. If you give the Ammonites into my hands, whatever comes out of my door, the door of my house to meet me when I return in triumph from the Ammonites will be the Lord's, and I will sacrifice it as a burnt offering. Now, that sounds all very devout and worthy. What is the man on? I mean, what is he expecting to come out of his front door when he returns in triumph? I mean, what? It's just nuts, isn't it? I mean, it's pretty bad if it's the pet poodle. You know, how's everyone going to feel if they, I said, didn't I? So it's going to be the poodle. I mean, I don't really like poodles, so fair enough. Worse, if it was a pug, it definitely has to go. No, please, no. I don't want letters. And I'm not budging in my prejudice. Anyway. Who does he think? I mean, don't you think his family are going to be on tenterhooks waiting to see him over the horizon coming down to the family house? When they see him, they're going to be rushing out to hug him. But when, of course, his daughter comes out, well, it's not rocket science. That was a pretty obvious option. His daughter or his wife or someone else in the house. And then, suddenly it's a surprise to Jephthah when it happens. He tears his clothes and says, oh, no, my daughter, you've brought me down to his daughter. And I'm devastated. I've made a vow to the Lord that I cannot break. What a complete and utter moron. I mean, it would be funny if it wasn't horrific. We don't have time. I was going to ask you to discuss whether or not you thought that was a good idea or not. What should he do? Well, I can tell you now, it was a bad idea, okay? So we don't need to discuss that. Was Jephthah right? No. Okay, that's the discussion. He definitely should not have done this. Now, the way Old Testament stories are told is that they rarely give you any indication of their view of the matter. You don't get the author saying, actually, this was a really bad idea and the Lord was cross. It just leaves it. Why? Because everything is written within the framework, under the umbrella of the law. So we know that human sacrifice is a bad idea. If Jephthah really understood his Bible, he would not have made that vow. And what a stupid vow anyway. Why put it in terms of whoever comes out of the front door? I mean, it would have been better to, you know, whatever comes out of the chicken coop first, I will sacrifice. Yeah, that makes more sense. But out of the front door? Should Jephthah have gone ahead with it? No. I'm sure the Lord would have preferred him to say, oh, sorry, Lord, I shouldn't have done that. Yeah, punish me for making a false, stupid vow, but I shouldn't kill my daughter. Oh, no, no, I've got to keep my vow. I'm going to kill my daughter. Terrible. God hates human sacrifice because God invented love. He invented life. He loves life. And it's not ours to dispense with. Because it's good, and we grieve even when it is a merciful release. And so then we come to Abraham and we think, what is going on here? Let's put it into context in the story. God promised a son. And a son did not appear for years and years and years and years. Abraham and Sarah finally pitch up to their local hospital, and there they are, toddling in at the front gate on their Zimmer frames. Geriatrics is over on the left. He says, no, we want maternity. It's ridiculous. You're having a baby at 93, or whatever it is. Well, good for you. It's a miracle. It made no sense until suddenly it did make sense. God has given them a son. It's hilarious. Sarah said, Genesis 21, God has brought me laughter, and everyone who hears about this will laugh with me. It's ridiculous. But who would have said to Abraham that Sarah would nurse children, and yet I have borne him a son in his old age? God promised a new life, and there was one. Decades on from the promise. Better late than never. And then in chapter 22, there's horror. Absolute horror. The way the story is told, it's told with brilliant precision. It's very spare, but it's so poignant. Almost every line just ratchets up the agony of it. We really feel Abraham's grim determination to obey God, to worship God, God's way, to do and live as God instructed. And we see Isaac's confused innocence. So he asks this plaintive question in verse 7 of 22. The fire and wood are here, but where's the lamb for the burnt offering? Talk about dramatic irony. We know, even if Isaac doesn't yet. But I thought life was good. In fact, it is a fact that previous generations of people in this country, as we all know, they were far more steeped in Christianity and the Bible than people are now. It didn't mean, of course, that they believed it all, but it was very much part of your education. Whatever school you went to, you would have Bible classes, you would know. And it means that basically you would recognize themes in Shakespeare. You cannot understand Shakespeare without the Bible. In Byron, or even the most sort of rebellious of poets and artists, but they were still drawing from the wells of Scripture. And Wilfred Owen was one of the greatest of the First World War poets. Obviously, he died very close to the end of the war. And he wrote one of his most horrific poems called The Parable of the Old Man and the Young. You'll see why I quote it as I read it. It's published in 1920, posthumously. So Abram rose and clave the wood and went and took the fire with him and a knife. And as they sojourned both of them together, Isaac the firstborn spake and said, My father, behold the preparations, fire and iron, but where the lamb for this burnt offering? Then Abram bound the youth with belts and straps and builded parapets and trenches there. And stretched forth the knife to slay his son, when, lo, an angel called him out of heaven, saying, Lay not thy hand upon the lad, neither do anything to him. Behold, a ram caught in a thicket by its horns. Offer the ram of pride instead of him. But the old man would not so, but slew his son and half the seed of Europe one by one. That poem is only shocking because we know the story. That's not what happened. That there was a ram, there was a substitute, there was one life for another. Owen was making a point about, you know, the old sort of saw about, you know, lions being led by lambs or donkeys. That's certainly what it felt like in the trenches. The history is actually more complex than that. But it felt like the older generation couldn't care less about the younger generation and just sacrificed the lot on the altar. Well, who knows what? But we know there is a divinely provided escape. Abraham answered, God himself will provide the lamb for the burnt offering, my son. And the two of them went together, but I dread to think what was going on in Abraham's head, don't you think? His eyes are peeled. Then at last, the angel of the Lord appears. Do not lay a hand on the boy. Do not do anything to him. Now I know that you fear God, because you've not withheld from me your son, your only son. You love me more than anything in the world. And the boy is saved. And so are the covenant promises. Right at its very source, its very heart, it is impressed on the whole nation that they exist out of the grace of God that he provided an alternative life for their life, for the nation's life. That is how precious this life is. The Lord hates human sacrifice. A substitute is provided. But what is fascinating is how the book of Hebrews applies this whole story, and this is where I'll end. Hebrews 11, the great sort of gallery, art gallery of faith, or portrait gallery, sometimes people describe it. But it's so interesting what they pick out, what is picked out in this gallery. And it's not always the thing you most expect of each of these characters, but this episode is definitely front and center when we're talking about Abraham. And it's all in the context of faith, believing and trusting God. We'll come back to the beginning of Hebrews 11 on Thursday. But this is what Abraham is commended for there. By faith, Abraham, when God tested him, offered Isaac as a sacrifice. He who had embraced the promises was about to sacrifice his one and only son, even though God has said to him, "It is through Isaac that your offspring will be reckoned." In other words, this very boy is the future, and I want you to kill him. Abraham reasoned that God could even raise the dead. And so, in a manner of speaking, he did receive Isaac back from the dead. Do you see? What is Abraham's logic? Even at this ancient, almost prehistoric moment, Abraham has a sense of who God is and what he's like and what he's into. He's into life. He made life. He loves life. And so he reasoned, okay, if I have to do this, there's going to be a resurrection. I have no idea how that's going to go. But that's the logic. That's the reason. That's the trust. God loves life. He is the Lord of life, and therefore, he can raise the dead. This is one of my favorite paintings of all time. Francisco de Zurbarán, painting after the Counter-Reformation, so some of it is very sort of extravagant, completely over-the-top Baroque Catholic art. But this is one of his most precious, and it's simply called The Lamb of God. Amen.